Well, thank you, Grace, for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here with you and to talk to you about a topic I got interested in 2 or 3 years ago. And it's something I actually put together a little book on, which we're now into more stuff on the University Press. We published earlier this year. And I'm going to talk about maroon communities in South Carolina. And the first thing I need to talk to you about is, what are maroons? And it's not a word that is commonly in French. It's a word that is a corruption of the Spanish word, cimarron. Cimarron in Spanish means an escaped thing that's usually used to describe escaped livestock. Livestock that have escaped from the pen and has run wild. And the Spanish used this term first of all in the Americas in 1600 to describe escaped slaves, because slaves of course were property. And this word became the word which is used throughout the Americas to describe runaway slaves. And it got corrupted into English as maroon. In French as marron, but in English it becomes maroon, and the act of running away becomes marronage. So you'll see those words used quite a lot in this talk, maroon and marronage. It's important to know that maroons aren't the typical runaway slave. Lots and lots of slaves run away from slavery for understandable reasons. Being a slave, you know, is not the most edifying prospect if you're looking for the rest of your life with unrelated drudgery, violence, rape, all those sorts of horrible things. So a lot of slaves run away. There are key differences though between how slaves run away. Most slaves who run away a short distance and they hide very locally to where they were based. And they usually last as runaways for about 2 to 3 days, because it takes you about 2 to 3 days to realise that you don't have the skills to survive. You don't know how to get food, you don't know where to get fresh water, and you're tired, you're hungry, you're cold, and a lot of us, most runaway slaves, go home after 2 or 3 days. A small number plan ahead, think ahead, and do have the right skills to sustain themselves for longer. And it's those sorts of people who I'm going to talk about. So they're people who will stay out as runaways for a much longer period of time, months, years, possibly even decades. So those are the sort of people who I'm interested in. When you talk about maroons, marronage, the important thing to remember is that when you look at the whole history of New World slavery, from 1500 through to 1888, when it's finally launched in Brazil, every slave society in the Americas has maroons. They are runaway slaves and escaped slaves are everywhere. Every slave society you look at, you will see maroon communities. They don't exist in certain places, they exist everywhere. However, there are certain places where maroons as an issue, as a problem, are particularly important. Key ones to remember are the Kingdom of Palmares in Brazil, which lasts for pretty much the entire 17th century, from about 1610 to about 1690. And it's a community of tens of thousands of runaway slaves. In the interior of Brazil, in the Amazonian jungles, in the Amazonian rainforests, it consists of many towns, it has a king, it has a tax structure, it has a military force, and you know, scholars often describe it as the Kingdom of Africa, which just happens to be in Brazil. That's probably the largest ever maroon community to exist in the Americas. Another really significant maroon community, or actually two of them, exists in Jamaica, in central Jamaica, where the mountains are. And again, it exists from the early sort of English settlements in Jamaica in the 1650s through to the modern day. These places in Jamaica become these sort of independent maroon communities that are sustained for beyond the end of slavery. And the third one also to remember is Suriname, on the coast of South America. It's a Dutch colony. The advantage, I think, that the slaves who were imported into Suriname in the 17th and 18th centuries is that they've got a very large area to work with. And Dutch settlement, the Dutch slave settlements are very much near the coast, so if you go south, then it's very difficult for the Dutch to follow these people. And all these three big areas, Palau, Jamaica, Suriname, have certain things in common. They have landscapes which are not easy for people to traverse. So they're not easily followed, they're not easily chased, they're not easily captured. If you're trying to send regular army troops or regular militia troops into jungles, into mountains, into swamps, into forests, these are not areas which regular troops like. Regular troops like open plains, fields with good lines of sight, where they can set up their artillery pieces and they can shoot big, you know, cannon at people. That's how they do it in Europe. Now, the Americas are like that. You know, almost no landscape in America is like that. And so what happens is that these Maroons specifically choose their locations where they know they are remote and also inaccessible and defensible. And so what they do is that they lay traps for the enemy. They put out secret trails. They put out false trails which may lead to, for example, hollowed out pits with sharpened stakes at the bottom. Then they sometimes put ambushes and sentries so that, for example, there's a pattern of arrows at a particular juncture, or they put sentries where they could, you know, throw things or fire at the soldiers. And in all of these environments, the big advantage that all the Maroons have is that the disease environment works in their favour. And the European troops are not accustomed to New World diseases. And so, as often as not, they die of malaria and all those sorts of tropical diseases, yellow fever, that doesn't impact the African and the African American population in the same degree. As these things sort of conspire so that these kingdoms can maintain themselves, if these Maroon kingdoms can maintain themselves. How do the colonial powers respond? Well, usually they try and attack a Maroon community once they know roughly where it is. They see it's a problem because you've got Maroons as a symbol of freedom, a symbol of what escaped slaves can become, which of course is attractive to those slaves who are hiding on plantations. So they say, it's a magnet for runaway slaves. And so if your plantation society reliant on slave labour, you can't have this sort of alternative pool for your slaves. So the actual response to white societies is to organise their militias, send out, try and destroy the Maroons. Sometimes they succeed, more often than not they don't. And so in places like Jamaica and in Suriname, what happens is that eventually the colonial governments come to some kind of formal treaty agreement with the Maroons. In 1739 in Jamaica, they sign a treaty, with the Maroons after a long and destructive war with the Maroons, which is very inconclusive. And the treaty says that British will recognise Maroons until the independence of freedom, on the promise that the Maroons will help them capture runaway slaves and send them back. And this treaty arrangement works quite well for the Maroons, and they agree, because although they succeed in maintaining their independence, fighting a continual war is also very draining. So, peace is better than war, in that sense. And the same exact same thing happens in Suriname, where these large groups of slaves in the south of Suriname are basically left alone. They are a long, long way from the plantation district. And the Dutch have this sort of agreement with them. Harmonize eventually does get destroyed by the Portuguese. The Portuguese don't really like this whole peace treaty system. Partly because they're trying for a while and it doesn't work, you know, with Harmonize. Eventually, they organise quite a lot of militia units to capture the main settlement of Palmares and they succeed in destroying it. But it's not long before there's another Maroon community in Brazil, and often that's what happens. You see a Maroon community destroyed, and yet within 5 years, another one has sprung up nearby, because in no instance are all the Maroons captured. They know the environment, they know the landscape, and sort of disappear into the woods, into the forests, into the jungles. So that's a bit of background about how sort of common Maroon societies are in the Americas. But what about North America? I mentioned North America. Well, as you might expect, the Maroon societies in North America as well. Particularly in Florida and of course in Louisiana. Now, Florida, which in the 18th century people describe as being more water than land, which is sort of right to think about anyways, is a classic environment for runaway slaves. Manchester criminal policy is encouraged, runaway slaves from South Carolina and Georgia into Florida as a way of annoying the British, and it's quite successful in that. Florida, of course, you know, the bayous of Louisiana, coastal Louisiana, has lots of areas where runaway slaves are congregated. And so this is a problem in North America as well as in Central America and the Caribbean. And this picture is of Trelawney Town, which is in the cockpit country of Jamaica, and it says at the bottom here, the chief residence of the Maroons. And this was done in the mid-18th century. But you can see it's a regular settlement. It's got buildings, it's got homes, no doubt communal buildings as well. They're here planting crops, they've got livestock. Here they are planting crops, this is livestock here. And you know, got fresh water. And you can see why this is an attractive lifestyle for a slave, for a former slave who's escaped from the sugar states of Jamaica, which are a terrible place to be if you're a slave. Sugar cultivation is one of the worst things to produce a slave. It's 12-month labour, there's no respite for winter. It's very, very hard work, especially during harvest. The death rate is incredibly high in places like Jamaica, over 80 in terms of violence. And so, if this becomes a viable alternative, you can see why these slaves think. Well, I need to talk about South Carolina, obviously. So let's put South Carolina in a bit of a historical context as well. Why are Maroons particularly common in South Carolina? Well, partly it's to do with geography. In that, if you live in the Berkshire University, you do this one, you're doing it very well, you realise how the local country is often very swampy, and this provides a lot of places where Maroons can go. These are places which are part of plantations, they aren't farm, but they do exist, and this is the geography that you have to work with. Well, that's exactly the kind of environment you want. If you're a runaway slave, you want somewhere where you can go, where you work with red meat and stew. Well, the swamps of the Carolina Low Country are a great big place where you can run away from hiding. The Low Country stretches from Georgetown down to, well past sort of Gary and George, maybe down as far as the Florida border, and it goes probably 50 miles inland. That's a large area. Secondly, you have a very large number of slaves in South Carolina. Second only to Virginia in North America. And the numbers rise from around 30,000 in the mid-18th century up to 150,000 by the time of the Civil War. The vast majority of those slaves are concentrated in the coastal area. And that's the other key indicator, is that 75% of the local country population is black in the 18th and early 19th centuries. And if you exclude Charleston from that, which is roughly 50-50, then more like 80-90% of the population is black. So you've got a very, very small white minority, which means any kind of policing patrolling system is going to be limited. They don't have the white manpower to do it. The other thing that makes South Carolina stand out from any other colony in North America is the very high, relatively high, percentage of African-born slaves in the slave population. Usually when slaves come to North America, they become creolized and become more African-American, that is born in America, quite quickly. South Carolina, that process is quite slow. You know, even in 1780, a third of the slave population in South Carolina was born in Africa. And although the slave trade is closed in South Carolina between 1787 and 1803, South Carolina is the only state to reopen the transatlantic slave trade for 4 years before the French Revolution in 1808. And in that 4 years, they imported over 40,000 Africans. And so South Carolina's population remains African for longer than any other part of North America. Why is that significant? Well, historians often say that African-born people are much more likely to run away than American-born people because they come with a ready-made memory of what it was like to be free. Conversely, of course, those who are born in Africa often don't have the right skills to run away and survive, because often what you need if you're going to run away are local knowledge of geography. You also often need a facility in English. You're going to have to sort of talk your way through certain situations to be able to speak English very well. And so, in some respects, having being an American boy is also great. Those statistics, the fact that South Carolina has a high proportion of Africans in its population, the fact that it has a very large number of slaves, and the fact that the outnumbers the white population. South Carolina, that's actually being part of the greater Caribbean. South Carolina fits well with Jamaica, Barbados, Antigua, St. Lucia, those kind of islands. It doesn't really fit at all with the rest of North America. It doesn't really fit even with Virginia, for that matter. You know, but for the geographical association that was stuck onto North America, you can easily see that South Carolina would be left behind on the American Revolution. That's all the other problems to find out. Now this map shows you Beaufort District. It was first done in 1825, and what I like about this map is that it shows you all the swamps. All these bits that are shaded with bits of trees, all the way up here, this is the Savannah River border in Georgia. None of this is settled by white people. None of this is part of the Plantation District. This is all just swamp. And so, if you live in Beaufort, which is just around here somewhere, I'm not so quite seeing where it is, but somewhere around there, then you haven't got that far to go to reach these kind of places, have you? And I took this picture just near Currisburg on the Savannah River. And so, this is a swamp right by the river. You can see the high water mark here. So this is a low water mark. This is a low water in the autumn, in our land sort of management. But if you came here in the spring, with all the snow melt calculations coming down the Savannah River, the water level would be a lot higher. And back when we had climate change 200 years ago, the water would be even higher. It means that these environments, these swampy environments, are not particularly attractive as places to venture into. Because once you walk into these swamps, several things happen. You encounter lots and lots of dangerous things that you don't really want to encounter at any sensible point in time, like alligators, like water viruses, like rattlesnakes. That's a little put me off going anywhere near for life. But also, you've got an environment which is very difficult to navigate. I mean, just looking at that picture there, you can imagine how you can get lost in that environment pretty quickly. Every tree is the same height. The landscape is almost dead flat. So how do you know where you're going? Well, only by sort of familiarity with the landscape to know where you're going. I mean, there's stories that appear in the newspapers, that this 18th century newspapers, of people getting lost in the woods and then reappearing like 2 weeks later, having to sort of wander around and living off berries and frogs and, you know, drinking rainwater. Misstep. And that's what the forests of the Carolina Lowcountry and the Georgia Lowcountry are like in this period. And this shows you a little bit more water. And again, it's that sort of endless expanse of cypress trees and swampy ground. Now, if you're a white person and you know you've got slaves that have run away into these forests, it doesn't particularly look appetizing to go and chase them because this doesn't look like any kind of landscape you can navigate very easily. By contrast, I think the next two slides show you quite clearly. Slaves tend to know the swamps quite well. And this is because, although if you looked at a map of South Carolina, drawn up by who owns what plot, if you put together all the plats that are in the South Carolina archives, and you matched up, you know, this is what this man owned, this is what this man owned, and you matched up all their plots, it looks like they own the entire country. You know, so far so good, it sort of makes sense. But what this map shows you is the blown up portion of the map between the Ashton River, which is over here, and the Edstone River, which is here, shows you that actually there's great big spaces, but here's one guy, and then you can go all this bit here, he's empty. Now, I mean, that's probably all his land, effectively, like recognized by the state being his land, but he probably only farms or plants on a very small bit of it. And that's true of all these people. They tend to be clustered near roads or near rivers, and all the bits behind them, the bits in between the rivers, are not really farmed. And this is where the slaves know, this is the environment the slaves might be very well, because on any plantation, the big house is in one portion of the estate. And the slave quarters are in quite a distant portion of the estate, because the planter did not want to have to look out his bedroom window in the morning and look at a slave quarter. So he stuck it 2 miles down the road because he had that plan of the good. And he made a slave walk those 2 miles to his field. But when it's not even that I hate it, it's actually my host where it's awesome. And then when they get time to themselves, for example, on Sunday, they're just slowly working on Sunday evenings after lunch, they get off and they come to the swamps, wild birds, ducks, pigeons, they're not believing the snakes, and all the different supplements their diet. And over time, this makes them quite familiar with eating the swamps. And it makes them a lot less fearful of entering into that environment because they're sort of used to it. And this map, which is of a plantation in the northern part of Charleston District, off the plantation, again shows you, look, these are the sort of swampy areas on the outskirts of the estate. Here's the big house. And look at all these places all the way around that aren't really being farmed. I mean, these rice fields are over here, and here, just next to the house. And so, you can become familiar with this environment without ever having to leave your master plan. And of course, this line here isn't a fence. It's just a notional line on a map. And so slaves, wander fairly freely across all this land. And as long as they turn up again at some point where they're supposed to be in the field the next morning, masters don't really care what slaves go to in there at the time, so long as they do where they're supposed to be. And so you have to gain a lot of knowledge in your own free time. Let's talk a little bit more specifically about specific events in your own history. There are examples of maroons as early as 1711. That's the first example I've ever come across. 1711. An example of maroons not far from here in the Eastern District. Causing trouble, raiding plantations, that sort of thing. And you get some other sporadic mentions in the 1730s and 1740s. There is some evidence, which I think is really intriguing, and it shows much more of it, to suggest that actually maroons may well have been involved in the Stoner Rebellion of 1739. The slaves who were who congregate on just outside of South Charleston in 1739 sort of suddenly appear out of nowhere, but they're right next to a swamp. And I wonder, whether some of the plantation slaves were augmented by maroons who were already there. Because it's very weird for suddenly 100 plus slaves to suddenly appear at one place and organise its rebellion. And so there are odd mentions of these maroons right the way through from the 1720s, 30s, 42. And then we get a big burst of maronage in the 1760s and 1770s. The 1765 Savannah River Maroon, which is quite a significant group, and it coincides with another completely separate group in Colton County, so in between the different charters. In early 1766, and these two coincide chronologically as large bodies of armed slaves, 70, 100 plus, roaming the countryside, raiding plantations, attacking militia units sent out to defeat them. And what's quite interesting is the timing, because this is the exact same time when Britain and America are completely loggerheads over the Stamp Act. Stamp Act is passed and comes into force in November 1769. And slaves took up on the fact that British authorities, British governors, and Americans, the people who are against the Stamp Act, are arguing, let's say, about the Stamp Act. And they pick up on that division really quite quickly. And they sort of exploit it. There's some ideas that they're going to be able to take advantage of the distraction of the Stamp Act. The fact that most elite South Carolinians and Georgians are involved with plotting how to stop the Stamp Act, and they're not so paying so much attention to their workforce and their controlling system. And this is the moment to run away. It's actually quite clever. White distracted, now the time to run away. And they do run away in large bodies into these swamps. On the north side of the Savannah River, and then in the central Minnesota, Hong Kong Island swamps in Colton County. They set up the militias. The militias are sporadically effective. They never capture that many maroons. They capture half a dozen at home. And the rest sort of melt away into the swamps. Some no doubt return to their plantations. crops growing, livestock. And so these are clearly permanent organisations. You know, they're not just being set up in the last few months. They've been there for quite a long time. But they're getting bolder, I guess, because of the division in wider society. But the South Carolinian and Georgian authorities do manage to sort of nip that in the bud in 1765-66, and things do wind down for a few years. But there are a couple of sort of sporadic missions in 1771 and 1772. The revolution then comes. The revolution is really interesting because of its effect on slaves in the Low Country. Those of you who know about the American Revolution, although the British authority collapses in the South very quickly in early 1776, and most of the British authority is sort of vanished, and the American Revolution forces control the South in 1776-1777. But in late 1778, British force comes and captures Savannah in December of 1778. And in the capture of Savannah, they are helped by black people in the Low Country. Because even before the Revolution, black people were fairly confident that the Revolution and the British were the British were on the side of the slave and not on the side of the Americans. There's lots of talk about how the war is coming between the slaves, how the king is going to send troops to free the slaves, and then you get people like Governor Dunmore of Virginia issuing a proclamation saying that slaves can join the army, and if they serve the British, they will become free. And of course, all this combined to make British seem like good guys in the Revolutionary War if you're a slave, and the Americans seem like bad guys. Within a year, 10 months, of the British capture of Savannah in 1778, the Americans launched the siege of Savannah in October 1779. And the British who were defending Savannah use slaves as auxiliary troops, working on fortifications and defences. And they also arm them and use them as infantry. And this is one of the first examples of the British using black troops towards aiding the revolutionary cause. And they are quite significant in successfully defending Savannah from the American French forces that they're taking, and the Americans give up and go away. And the British forces augmented and then marched to South Carolina in 1780, captured Charleston, and controlled quite a lot of the country by South Carolina in 1780. Throughout the period of the Revolutionary War in the South, so from 1778 to 1782, wars sort of ebbs and flows between British successes and American successes. And as each side takes over land and plantations formally ruled by the other, they divide the slaves as sort of spoils of war. And then what they do when they lose that land and they give it back to the British or give it back to the Americans, so the Americans or the British then divide it again. So there's a lot of confusion going on. And what happens to slaves who land on the plantations? They usually take advantage of the hiatus of the gap in authority to run away. And so sometimes masters come back to a plantation which they think they own, and all that is there are buildings, and there are no slaves there at all. All the slaves run away. And they don't know where to find them. And they don't know, and these sort of court cases go on for years looking for slaves they thought they had. Eventually, of course, the British lose the Revolutionary War, and when Cornwallis is defeated in 1781, the British still control the Low Country, they still control Charleston's plan. But as the peace negotiations are going on in Paris, the British agree to evacuate the cities. Savannah in July of 1782, Charleston in December of 1782. And with the fleet taking away the British army, they take away thousands and thousands of former slaves whom they're free. And these are slaves who have helped the British during the war, and they dare leave them behind because of what their masters would do to them if they found them. And so several thousand slaves are taken, former slaves are taken either to the Caribbean, a sizable portion of them in Nova Scotia, and eventually they end up in Sierra Leone in Africa. Which again is interesting. But not all the black troops who were formerly British in the 1780s end up being taken away. Some are left behind. And you accept green enslavement, you will just return to your plantation and think, well, I've got another 30 years of being a slave. Or do you think, well, I've had a taste of freedom, what I'm going to do is try and recreate my free life somewhere else? And certainly a sizable number of them do that. They run away, they hide, and the place they hide here is in the Savannah River swamps, between Puritsburg over here and South Bernice, California. Now, this is a natural island formed in the Savannah River, and it's again a classic Maroon location because it's inaccessible, it's just all swampy land. There are no plantations on it, there are no white people right next to it. White people don't go anywhere near the swamp. They travel up down the river, of course. And this road, which is marked on, this is a British military map, 1780, road that crosses the swamp here, I think it was only a military road because no other map shows it. But we do know that the British Army did cross the Savannah River around this point, which makes me think, well, maybe some of the black troops with the British at the time saw this and thought, ah, this looked like a good location for later. Anyway, that's going to my next. But these runaway slaves, people who fought with the British, end up on this island, and they live here for a number of years, because we don't really hear anything about them until 1786. So that's 4 years after the British left, and finally hear that there are a large body of runaway slaves encamped on this island. And they're encamped on the south bit of this creek, this Bear Creek, and they're encamped around here. And we know this because of the description of soldiers and military dispatches, that they had this large camp, and they had sentries, well, multiple levels of sentries. They had sentries right next to the camp, they had sentries 2 miles downriver, as they fall, you know, up here. The sentries up here, they had sentries near the camp. The camp was surrounded by a palisade, and the palisade was very tightly done so that you couldn't very easily get into it. So you'd only get one person into the camp at any one time. These were all classic defensive tactics. And if you were a student of African history, you would find exactly the same tactics used in Africa for fortifying the settlements, which again shows you the legacy of the African influence among slaves in the local country. They managed the Georgia militia mounted an expedition against the Imperial in October of 1786, which is sort of successful, and they destroy the town. But they can't get any help from South Carolina, so the South Carolinians aren't interested. Well, after they destroy the town here, the Maroons end up sort of on this bit of the river, you know, this swampy bit here, and this swampy bit here, and they start attacking the plantations which are over down here. And that's when South Carolina starts to get alarmed, because you get people waiting for their state representatives in the legislature in Columbia saying, you need to do something about these Maroons, because, you know, last week I had, you know, 20 of them come and steal all my sheep, or I had 20 of them come and steal 3 of my slaves. And one of them said that if I didn't carry on feeding him, he was going to come and kill me. Well, you know, these sort of letters arriving in Columbia do register as far as possible. And so in April, May of 1787, so this is 6 months later, South Carolina and Georgia organize their militias together. And they do manage a very successful campaign, and they kill a reasonable number of slaves, and they capture some, and disperse the rest, so far as they know. But certainly some of the Maroons end up heading north towards the Cherokee Creek territories in northern Georgia. But why I put this bit over here is that General Jackson, who the fourth revolution was, fourth in the siege of Savannah, when he's the one who actually destroys one of the settlements, he leads the force to destroy the settlements. And he says that these people were the very people who fought in the siege of Savannah. And he says they called for themselves the King of England soldiers, which does that directly back to 1782 and 1778. It shows you for a long period of time that these people are remembering this whole issue of freedom and slavery and how they never resisted. This idea of the King of England soldiers still fighting a revolutionary war 5 years after it finished, you know, it's fascinating. Maroons don't disappear after the revolutionary war. It's a bit quiet for a period. or encouraging Roman activity in Carolinas. There's some fear in Charleston and suspicion directed at the French consul in Charleston, but there's been no evidence that he was a penal or in his place were involved in any kind of prisoner. And there's a few more examples associated with the War of 1812, which is when the British come back for a rematch of the Revolutionary War, and they spend most of the War of 1812 annoying the Americans by making like William Washington, without any really intention of conquering America. They just sort of like have a bit of fun blowing things up. And eventually they lose that war as well. But the War of 1812 was a really interesting war because the cause of the war, which is all about the enlistment of American soldiers by the British Navy, had been repealed before the Americans actually declared war. So the cause of the war wasn't all on the valid when the Americans declared war, anyway. And then the peace treaty was agreed between Britain and America in 1814. And then after the peace treaty is the main battle of the war, which is the Battle of New Orleans, which the Americans win. So the only case I can think of history where the main battle of the war happens after the peace treaty. Anyway, back to my topic. The next really interesting figure is a guy called Joe. Sometimes he calls himself Forrest. So I, give you an idea of the Forrest Joe. He's a Maroon leader, and he's first shoots to prominence in South Carolina in 1821, because he and a few of his gang reigned for this plantation here, the Ford plantation of George Ford, right on the southern tip of South Island. This is just south of Georgetown, and this is the North Santee, this river here. So they raid this plantation for cattle. Ford goes out to investigate, and one of the Marines fires at Ford and kills him. This is covered extensively in Charleston newspapers, because it's not every day that a plantation owner gets killed in his own plantation by a whole load of slaves. And there's a really, really big advantage for Joe and his companions. They capture one very quickly, who's called Jack, and they capture another one who's also called Jack, which I just thought would be really, really confusing. If that was a band, there were two of them were called Jack. But anyway, they capture these two Jacks fairly quickly. But Joe himself escapes, and he spends most of the next 6 months hiding around here in these swamps. And the newspapers are full of, we've sent out X numbers of militia, we've sent out army companies, we're going to find him. And then it's like, we've got in the corner, we know exactly where he is, he can't possibly escape. And then 3 weeks later, we don't know where he's gone. He was there, but now he's not. Well, periodically they say, we've caught him, and then a week later, actually, it was another guy. The newspapers are wonderful, of course, with rumours and misinformation. And the interesting thing about Joe, Forrest Joe, is that he doesn't come from down here. He doesn't come from down here. This is the Ford plantation right here. He comes from here. From the southern part of Richland District, this is Columbia now, here. And this is where the water in the Congaree form the Sandine. And he comes from a plantation on one of these rivers here, probably this river. And he spent a lot of time in these swamps here, on the northern side of here, all over here. And you hear of him over the next 2 years, up here, around here, quite often here, as well as all the way down here. Now this is 150 miles, probably more if you take into account all the bends of the river. And what's very clear about him is that he is complete master of this domain. This is his territory. He's not only got gangs down here, he's got other camps, other gangs, all the way up this river. And they all acknowledge him as the leader. Now, you can very readily think of him as like a Robin Hood figure, or he's a heroic. He's fighting against injustice, against slave owning, and all that sort of stuff. Well, what he sort of is, but then when you read more about him, he's just going to actually a bit of fun, and he's really just a bandit, and he's in it for himself. Because he doesn't discriminate against who he picks on. He's quite happy to kill, other slaves. There's one case where he goes and kills a driver on a plantation.
authorities have no idea where he is, and I've got no clue on any plan to catch him. And they've tried everything. They've tried sending militia groups, they've tried sending small groups, big groups, they've tried searching here, searching there, and they just can't do it. And eventually, he gets his comeuppance in this little area here, which is the northern part of the Charleston district, and is now, I think, probably under Lake Marin or Lake Moultrie, one of the two. It's very near to where the entry to the Santee Canal was, which is here. This is the canal between the Cooper River here and the Santee, which shortcut to Charleston, which was built through here. And it's very near there. And this is the boiler of Bitterman. And this is the canal, so where he is somewhere. And he was in control of all this sort of swampy area. And then figuratively, as I say, sending people out. And it's quite entertaining to read the diary accounts. A lot of them are not. But Francis, you know, interposing themselves. You know, Francis, so-and-so got shot by another Francis because, you know, somebody moved in the bushes and got, you know, bookshop, you know, entered the bad egg or something like that because they, you know, they managed to look at the bookage. Eventually, though, these Francis here close together and form something called the Pineville Police Association. And they offer rewards to slaves to help them catch Horace Jones. And this brings out one particular slave who's called Royal, who is a patroon, which means he commands a boat. The boat which goes up and down the Santee, that's his job, is that he navigates the Santee. Taking goods from one place to another. So he's obviously very familiar with the river. He's also very familiar with Joe. And one responds and says, I can get this guy out of Abbey because I can get him to come out to my boat and pretend that I'm going to trade with him, that I'm going to, you know, swap goods and barter with him. All he needs to do is lie in wait. So within just a few days of the Pineville Police Association adopting this tactic of bribery, it succeeds. And he lures Horace Jones out of the swamps, and there's a party of white men ready there with guns. They all shoot and Joe kill him. And they chop his head off and stick it in the middle of the river as a warning, just near the entrance to the canal. And this sort of again delays the whole sort of the idea of a united black front against white society in South Carolina. In general, there probably is, but there are also always people who step outside that limit as well. In that, for people like Royal, and there are people who don't think that Joe was a good idea. And there are reasons why that Joe's proven himself to be violent against white people as well as white people, so there's a good reason. But also, Joe's probably affecting the river commerce, and therefore his livelihood. Because if he's acting like a black-haired pirate, and he's taking goods from the boats that go up and down the river, Royal was then saying they're responsible for the losses on the boat, then you can understand why he had an incentive. He's also got a personal motive because he's then freed by the South Carolina legislature, which is a very rare event in 1970 South Carolina, for the legislature to free a slave for this sort of conduct. So Horace Jones is a really interesting character because he has this sort of dual sort of Robin Hood stroke bandit existence, and that's why I find him quite interesting. I've talked a little bit about the history of Marines, but I want to say a little bit more about how they organise themselves. How do they create a Maroon community? Where do they get that Maroon community from? Well, the obvious thing is that they get the Maroon community from the slaves. That is the source of all Maroons, that community. Some of that recruitment is voluntary, it's people who run away to join the Maroons. But a significant part of that is also involuntary. It's the room for any plantation smaller groups, and they don't get a choice. You know, think of that woman who Forrest Jones took. She didn't sound like she was particularly voluntary. So there's both voluntary and involuntary recruitment. Maroon groups that exist in London, though, also run by natural immigrants. So there are plenty of examples of children being born into Maroon. How do they survive? Well, they try and survive probably as much as possible by self-sufficiency. If they've got the space, they will plant crops. They'll plant sweet potatoes and other vegetables, perhaps real livestock. They will hunt. I mean, the swamps are full of food if you know how to hunt them. And slaves generally do know how to hunt them. They will also, the raid plantations, especially if they're like cattle, figure in that they only cost so many cows to always hunt them. You know, but masses do miss, you know, the old cow. So, figuring out how to survive in the wilderness and how to survive in the swamps is always complicated, always difficult. You know, not many people could do that. And it's, you only have to watch Survivor, you know, on TV to know that people aren't very good at, you know, learning how to survive now. Well, they were a bit better in the 18th century because they had to, but there's a lot of people who weren't equipped with the skills necessary. You also get, eventually, you have to be able to defend your country, your community from attack. And it's, those military tactics are actually quite interesting because they clearly have, in many respects, military training. When you have to look at all those defensive works, the fucking post centuries, that shows military training. And the people probably have military training to be, you know, they have to. Or maybe the military in British production. They're often armed. The number of guns that these people have is astonishing. And yet, although you might think slaying their own guns, well, that makes sense as well, but they clearly were given guns in order to hunt. We've got common displays of patterns. What's the short supply is not weaponry, it's ammunition and powder. If you think about how they die, and often they break plantations with powder and musket shot, and they don't break the weapons themselves, they have those weapons. It's also easy for us to think that weapons are wonderful things and they are very dangerous for slaves to possess. But we still remember that 18th century weaponry is particularly accurate, and we're far more likely to kill something with a bow and arrow. The other word that you've got right through until probably the 20th century. And so the fact that George Foreman was killed by gunshot wound wasn't really part of that. Because even if there were any left in there, Foreman missed it. And also, the other thing to remember is how did they get on with plantation slaves? A lot of the time, plantation slaves were people who support wounds. They provide them with food, they provide them with information, where the best things are, and where the best food is, all that sort of stuff. But then they also, as in the case of oil, they control the wounds for their own personal benefit. So, it is a slightly love-hate relationship, and that is a relationship which is actually quite interesting, and we would certainly do more about it, probably I'll write an article on it at some point, when I get the time. And so how do white people respond to Marines? Well, it begs several questions. A lot of the time, white people don't know that Maroon communities exist. And if you're doing your job properly as a Maroon, you will try not to be noticed. Because if white people don't know you're there, then they're not going to know anything to kill you, are they? Even if white people do know you're there, they will probably go to reasonably great lengths to pretend you're not there. Because when the possibility is you have to go into the swamp to try and kill the Maroons, with all the alligators and the snakes, and the Maroons are armed, that's not particularly an attractive prospect, is it? Certainly not, I wouldn't think that's, I'm going to go and speak to some armed people when they know the environment much better than I do. Well, that's what a lot of times just think. If they're not causing too much trouble, let's just leave them alone. If they are causing a little bit too much trouble, then they try and do these sort of verbal attempts, these sort of petty, they band together in groups of, you know, a dozen planters, 20 planters, thinking numbers, that's what they're going to do. And then they sort of move on in there, on the Maroons. These sorts of attempts can be successful. I've often done them, they're sort of a more for show. And they make a show of that they were trying to get rid of the Maroons, and they're plotting on any game, any other time. The fourth stage is getting this, the proper authorities involved, getting the army, the militia involved, sending out not just 20 men, but 200 men, with all armed with cannons as well, with boats, people who know how to do those things, led by proper commanders. These are the expeditions that I'm excited to see. And they're even more likely to see when they're augmented by Indians. South Carolina has a long history, right back as far as 1765, of using the Catawba Indians from upstate South Carolina, which is border South Carolina and North Carolina, bringing them down against the Indians, maybe against the Maroons. And they do this because they believe that the Indians have the right hunting tactics. They know how to hunt these sorts of people in these sorts of environments. And also, South Carolina goes to quite significant lengths to create animosity between Indian tribes and white slaves. The cost they are, potentially they're grouped together, terrifying, because you know there's a prospect of an anti-white front. So they try and split those two groups off. And they encourage, for example, slaveholders amongst the Cherokee, another Indian tribe. But the Catawba are quite successful in hunting the Maroons, and they do that quite extensively, right the way through the 18th century. Once the 19th century comes, the problem South Carolina has is that there aren't any Indians to be left to do this for them. Catawba are now talking like 20 people, whereas in the 18th century they were 200. And so they just don't have the manpower to do that for that service for the South Carolina government. And that's why people like Forrest Jones, who spent 2 years wandering down the Santee to his heart's content, knowing full well that no white person is going to come within 5 miles of him. Because even today, if you try to cross the Santee, how many roads cross the Santee normally? It's not easy to get actually close to the river by driving. And you would go a long way around to get anywhere where you can actually see the river itself. After 1830, there seems to be some kind of a decline in Maryland, which, you know, is interesting of itself, and I think it's perhaps explained by two or three different reasons. It may be that you get fewer African-born people, which certainly shows that the 19th century progresses, the proportion of Africans will drop since the slave trade is closed in 1830. But that only holds true if you believe the theory that it's the African born who are more likely to be Maroons, which I think you could argue either way. You could also say that, oh, perhaps the groups aren't quite so big, and therefore they're not coming to white potential quite so much, and maybe they're getting better at being Maroons. As I said to you before, the ideal Maroon is the one that you can't hunt. There's some suggestion that there are fewer places to kind of hide in, though again, that argument to my mind doesn't really hold true. The South Carolina population, the white population, does grow, but mainly in Charleston. And even today, there's still large empty spaces in South Carolina. As a European, when I come to America, when I come to places like South Carolina, what strikes me as how empty the state is. I can drive an interstate, and I'll be the only car on the bit that I can see. Whereas if you go to Europe and you drive one of my motorways, you'll be the only car that you can see in the next 3 feet, and I'll be the only car that I can see. There's some suggestion that, especially after 1830 and the rise of radical abolitionism in the North, that the North becomes a preferable alternative to Maroon activity. I can see why people would think that. The problem with that argument is that it's a long way from South Carolina to Pennsylvania. Hundreds and hundreds of miles. And the numbers of slaves who actually run away that far and get to that kind of free state is minuscule. Most runaway slaves that cross the border are coming from Maryland and Virginia, or you know, the border states, Missouri. They're not coming from South Carolina or Georgia. Another alternative that suggests is that white people start fighting about it anymore. They're sort of self-censoring. And they've done this in the past. You only have to look at the Stone Rebellion, huge slave rebellion in South Carolina in 1739, not a whisper of it in South Carolina today. Because you don't want to add publicity and opposition, which you know, slaves might never get to learn about. So this initiative is also a possibility. But I don't really have a really good explanation for this decline. But certainly the records are a lot fewer. You get sporadic examples, which enough to suggest to me that it doesn't disappear. I think for whatever reason we showed the kind of records to tell you a bit more about that. So, the things to take away from the Bible are that Maynard is endemic in South Carolina. I think it exists probably throughout the period of slavery in South Carolina. I think we could find out a lot more if we use Mark Rush's work. I guess I'd throw that in because he's archaeological. This is an archaeological. Some people in South Carolina, I think, the University of South Carolina, people are trying to do some work in the Savannah River Islands. Mark Rush's work last year. But unfortunately, they came up with nothing, which is a real shame, because it's almost certain that work happens there. But there is archaeological evidence in a dismal spot on the border between North Carolina that suggests there was occupation of those parts, but the higher elevations of the swamp, the drier parts, in the 18th century, which was almost certainly done by the West Coast. And the other thing to take away from the talk, I think, is that Maynard told you that there is an entire black world in South Carolina that exists. In addition to the white world of plantation homes and crop growing and exporting and all that kind of thing, there's a whole sort of different take on South Carolina history if you look at it from a white perspective, which involves these marginal liminal landscapes of swamps and woods and forests, which black people made claims to work, and it's actually the white people made claims to work, but the black people were actually used and managed. Get students on a day-to-day basis, and that's what makes it quite an interesting topic. It's usually a Wednesday or into that kind of world. Okay, that's all I'm going to say.